Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Marco Sippi.
On today's show, we'll be discussing what makes a good book and judging a few by their covers with designer Jessica Helfand.
We'll also be discussing artist and filmmaker Beatrice Gibson's new piece, Crone Music, which calls on friends and collaborators to explore the value of community in an increasingly atomised age.
And we'll be hearing more art chat from installation artist Keith Morrison along with sound artist Beatrice Dillon. They'll be discussing their new project, Ecstatic Material, at the end of the show.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we'll enjoy some music too right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So happy Sunday, Tom Edwards. How are you doing today?
Not too bad at all, Marcus. And in lieu of a big old Sunday lunch, here we are at noon London time for the weekly. I wouldn't rather be anywhere else.
You know, I had such a massive Sunday brunch and actually roast as well that I had to have a few black coffees to wake up before I joined you in the studio.
Let me just
proper
get this straight.
Finnish style.
You had brunch and lunch all before midday?
I know. It's a very hedonistic Sunday for me this time.
He wears it very well, listeners. What else has been happening this week? I mean, you've been gorging yourself. Did you gorge on the celebration of capitalism that is the World Economic Forum in Davos?
And once again, I didn't get an invitation, did you? Well, you've been here, so obviously.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean I wasn't invited.
Mm-hmm. I know.
However, I wasn't invited.
However, I'll be boarding a plane later this evening, by the way. I'm heading to Madrid for one of the world's largest food fairs. It's Madrid Fusion time again, Monday, Tuesday, and even Wednesday. So I'll be there for a couple of days checking out what's going on in that
front.
So
you've been overindulging to get yourself into gross overconsumption shape.
To get myself on
readiness.
The right mood. I can tell you there's quite a lot of freebies available over there. I've been there before. So it's quite dangerous to be in this massive conference hall, walking from one stand to another, just, you know, tasting what they have there in offer.
If you keep eating like this, you can just roll along from one stand to the next.
I got my personal trainer booked already for next week, Wednesday morning, 8 a.m.
And presumably we'll be hearing about the food delights of Madrid in a prospective future episode of The Menu with Marcus Hippie.
Already on Friday's edition of that show, 1900, London time, 11 a.m. in Los Angeles.
Now, what could be more appetizing than that? Well, I've got one thing for you.
What
a look ahead
have?
At next week's news today with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, welcome. What have you got for us?
Well, I've got more trade fairs. I'm sure you guys love those. I'm very interested, actually, to hear the menu and what Marcus will be eating there. Is it mainly Spanish or quite international, Marcus?
No, it's meant to be all international. But what I always find really amusing is that despite this being one of the world's biggest events of its kind and truly international, I still tend to get all my press materials in Spanish.
I can help you with that.
There you go. He's a man
Por supuesto.
He's a man of many talents.
Well, I'm taking you guys to Frankfurt. It's Paper World, which started yesterday, actually, and is going to be on until Tuesday. And, you know, if you like paper and stationery, it is...
Fernando, I love paper, as regular listeners will know.
Me too. I mean, and I wonder, I would love to go there to see their selection of pens, you know, because it's very hard to see what they have on offer. But all I know, there'll be more than 1,600 exhibitors and from 66 countries.
Is it too early to say what the talk of the town in Frankfurt is going to be this time?
It is early, but they have quite a lot of things on their, you know, press material about the modern office, you know. So I think there'll be a lot of kind of discussion and seminars about what constitutes a modern office. Even though, to be fair, I'm still more interested in the pens in a way. But it'd be such an interesting place to go if you like any type of stationery.
And what I like, Faye, is I imagine that they do acknowledge the existence of the digital realm. But, you know, it's about paper. It's about pens. A lot of people would have you believe that the modern office has no paper or pens in it whatsoever. And we say, nonsense.
Nonsense. Absolutely. And, you know, and it's good that it's hosted in Germany because they have good stationery themselves. I'm sure, for example, companies like Gemund, they will be there. They have amazing, even though I have a complaint against them. I think they stopped producing the note cards that they used to do. I mean, I'm a bit sad for that.
What's your favorite piece of stationery?
The pen that I'm holding right now, they are from a Japanese brand, Pilot G-Tech C4. It needs to be the C4 because they have very fine lines. And I have a box with 24 of them. From each color.
Good.
Rainbow.
What else do you have for us, by the way? What else is happening this coming week?
Can we stay in Germany?
Please do.
It's another trade fair starting on the 30th of January. It's Tom, you might need to help me with
I
that.
I think I know which one it is. Is it Spielwarenmesse?
Yes.
My favourite fish. Spielwarenmesse, just because I want to pronounce the same word again as
Good
well.
Good now. I can't wait.
I mean,
tell listeners, though, because they may not be familiar with what this is.
It's the biggest toy fair in the world, and they're celebrating 70 years this time.
Marcus, what was that very first fair like? We'll probably have some coverage in one way or another on Monocle 24. But it's like something from a Roald Dahl novel, the biggest toy fair in the world. And it's really like that. It's an absolute treasure trove of delights, isn't it, Fernando?
Do you want to know the trends for this year?
Oh, 100%.
Yes, please.
I mean, it's good to know, actually, because, you know, as you know, kids are becoming slightly lazy, you know, with all those iPads and everything. So I think sports-based toys will be very much
good.
In. So, for example, there's a new kind of scooter, and it's called Highway Kick 1. They're very little. It's for kids for 1 to 5, and apparently it's going to be a hit.
Around my neighbourhood, they're scooting like it's going out of style.
But if you don't want to go as far as buying a scooter for your kid, I mean, there's also the Hachi Babies, which basically it's an egg. And the children, they have to care for the egg. At some point, it will hatch, and it might be a boy or a girl. So that's another trend.
Tom, do you remember when you turned 45 when you got your Tamagotchi?
it's kind of a Tamagotchi in real life, in a way.
I mean, and then what happens to it? Can the children fail to take good care of it? And then what does it? Because I don't know, Tamagotchi, they used to complain and then perish. It was all a bit sad.
I think it might happen the same. So I mean,
what's it called? A hatchy?
The hatchy babies.
Is there anything else, by the way, this coming week should be paying attention to?
Yes. Dior in London. There's the exhibition at the V&A Open on the 2nd of February. And again, fashion exhibitions, you know, they do so well. And the V&A saying this is the biggest exhibition they had since the one they did with Alexander McQueen back in 2015. Which,
that was an absolute blockbuster, rewrote the record books, didn't it?
And I got to be honest, this exhibition here, it was, I think, exhibited in Paris last year, but they made a few changes here and there. So, for example, Dior had a fascination, you know, the original designer of the brand had a fascination with the UK. So there'll be a section there saying why the UK influenced so much of his work as well. So I predict this will be a blockbuster exhibition, and I'll certainly be heading to the V&A to check this out.
Yeah, everyone had better to try to get the tickets as soon as possible.
Fernando, great to speak with you as always. And intriguingly, you were talking about the delights of paper. We're going to be reveling in the joys of a book, not just the paper, but the cover art as well, when we hear from Jessica Helfand in just a moment, here on The Weekly. They're some of the most oft-repeated, time-tested and ever-relevant words of wisdom to live by. Don't judge a book by its cover. But you can judge a cover by its cover, or by the design upon it, at least. That's what our first guest will be doing over the coming weeks. She's Jessica Helfand, co-founder of the Design Observer website, an essential stop for anyone wishing to stay informed on design news and features. She also teaches design at Yale and co-hosts her own podcast, The Observatory.
Design Observer, along with AIGA, the American Institute of Graphic Arts, have just opened their annual contest, 50 Books, 50 Covers, in which they look at where book design is headed each year. The winners will be judged in April, but to give us a head start, Jessica Helfand joins us on the line now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Jessica. So first of all, this competition does have a rather long history, doesn't it?
It does have a very long and distinguished history. In fact, it was started in 1923 and has run consistently since that time, which tells you something about the value of books over time.
Well, that's a question I wanted to put to you, Jessica, which was about the impact that the digital realm, I suppose, has had. I mean, people have long pronounced, and we've grown tired of putting them right, you know, the death of print, whether that's newspapers or others. But they've said, look, you know, the book and its cover is less relevant in the digital age. But I presume you would advocate the position that the absolute opposite is true.
There is a very strong audience, I think, for books, and book designers in particular feel, I think, a fierce loyalty to books and book design and editorial design as a medium that's not really going anywhere. I think one of the exciting things when you look back empirically over the years, and all of these books have been digitized and archived so future scholars, even current scholars, can look at them, one of the things you see is that, like any competition, they become in and of themselves a time capsule of what is important at that moment. And that can be everything from a technological conceit, like what cameras are available available to shoot certain kinds of photographs, to typography, to really incredibly inventive, progressive, innovative ideas by designers working very closely in concert with editors and writers. And so there's not a lot of duplication year to year. And what you see, I think, is really very much a sort of resonance test for what is of value in the kind of cultural zeitgeist of any moment.
What is happening with book design now? Where is it headed?
Well, you'd probably get a different answer if you asked a publisher or an agent or a writer, or a writer awaiting in advance. I think that, you know, bookstores certainly are shutting down. Amazon is taking care of a lot of that. The small independent booksellers are, I think, an imperiled species. But I don't think that that means that books themselves are going anywhere. And this is the classic, you know, horses didn't die off when cars were introduced. But it's an interesting thing. It ebbs and flows. I was on a flight last year going somewhere. I don't remember where. But the flight attendant came over and he said to me, "I just have to interrupt you because you're the only person on this entire airplane who's reading an actual book." Now, this didn't mean that people weren't reading, right? There were Kindles, there were iPads, there were laptops, people were watching films. And there's, of course, with portable media, we can read and watch and experience all kinds of platforms at any given point. But the book is portable. And I think I would say one other thing that I think bears mention. Abbott Miller, who's a dear friend of Design Observer's and a partner of Michael's, my partner Michael Beirut, a partner at Pentagram, once said about books that a book is a movie that you hold in your hand. And I think one of the enchanting things that never goes away about books is the sequencing and the editorial sort of flow of what it is to make an idea both verbal and visual over time. And the fact that one person at one time experiences the reading of one book, it's a very magical experience. And we find each year when we look at the 50 books and 50 covers that from over 800 entries that we get from all over the world, that there are designers and editors everywhere who have not stopped in trying to really advance the cause of making reading an enjoyable and magical experience.
And Jessica, just to pick up on that point you mentioned there about the portability of books, but also this haptic quality, you know, the tactile experience. It's a physical thing. Presumably many people, including those artists who perhaps specialize in or particularly enjoy designing or doing graphic art for books, it's the fact that they're making a physical object, isn't it? And that is something that, however good the resolution on a screen might be or however huge the screen might be, that never is going to compare with the physical object. I mean, does that remain something that maybe even elevates this art form above some others?
Oh, I think it absolutely does. I mean, we see all kinds of books. We see paperbacks. We see series of books. We see hardbound books with very complicated cover constructions. And then there's the interior of the book and the journey that that takes you on. I can only speak for my own books. I write and design my own books. And my last book, I designed with no hyphenation. Now, why did I do this? Because I felt that the experience of reading that book was a calmer, more sort of gentle ride than your eyes darting from the end of one paragraph to the beginning of the next. It's a simple conceit. In the case of the particular book I was working on, it felt really like it made sense. What you can do with scale, what you can do with sequence, what you can do with the materiality, to your excellent point about the thing you hold in your hands, not only is it a kinetic experience in terms of the sequence, as Abbott Miller says, but it's also a physical object and something that I think you do at your own pace. And I think as much as media in and of itself takes us all kinds of places and connects us in all kinds of ways through platforms that never stop, the book has its own kind of engine. It's a very personal engine. It's a very poetic kind of thing. And I think every year we see all kinds of things, all kinds of ideas for books that become books. Sometimes you see a book that becomes a film that turns into a book. Books happen after Broadway shows go into, you know, incredible, successful long runs. And so there's also this kind of almost reverse engineering of what is a book in terms of capturing an experience that might be temporal or kinetic in a different way. And so if anything, I think books have not only a long and rich history, but a wonderful and very certain future.
Let's talk about practicalities of this competition, 50 books, 50 covers. So you get, what, 700 or 800 books, physical objects. How do you choose the 50 best?
Well, we choose by having a jury, and I can tell you that this year I'm chairing the jury. We've got three people, and I'd like to name them if you'll permit me. It's a wonderful Dutch designer who has a practice in New York and teaches at Yale named Henk van Essen. a wonderful book designer who works privately in her own studio here in Connecticut named Daphne Geismar. Wonderful, wonderful book designer. And then finally finishing, rounding out our jury is Lucinda Hitchcock, who is on the faculty at the Rhode Island School of Design and also a really seasoned, amazing book designer. So these are three people who I know personally who've worked on academic books. They've worked on big books for publishers like Abrams and Rizzoli. They're experienced makers, practitioners, and educators. And so I think what happens is you get in this room, you're faced with this, you know, embarrassment of riches, incredible amounts of work in different languages, in different materials, in different mediums. And, you know, we go through very carefully. It takes a full day. And I would say that the experience of looking at the book interiors is quite different from looking at the covers. What you said at the top of this podcast is very true. There's a moment in which you feel that judging a book by its cover is inappropriate, that, you know, in a perfect world, we would all have 6 or 8 months to read through every single book and make a really educated decision about what, in fact, has been made visually manifest. But, of course, we can't do that. And people do. I mean, on a purely commercial basis, people do choose books based on what they look like. They put them on their coffee tables. They show them off to friends. They carry them in public and in coffee shops based on what they look like. And, of course, that does become a selling point for publishers, even though the independent bookstores are imperiled. I think people still, on Amazon, for example, you still can not only look at the book, but look inside, and you can read a sample chapter. So I think more and more attention is paid to the cover. One thing we're finding that is really interesting question about scale is that because books are sold online, and this is not just an Amazon question, my last two books were with MIT and before that with Yale, and I found this in each case that a book catalog has to read at postage stamp size, right? So I mean the book cover itself, the catalogs actually have to deliver the information so that the scale works at a very small, small dimension. And that's a challenge for book designers, particularly for book designers who are doing really big oversized coffee table books. So over time, I think there are these small moves that we try to take into consideration. But the final thing I would say in terms of what I think tends to get into the show is you have to ask yourself, why this book and why now? Why not last year or next year? What is it about this moment? Is it political? Is it about gender diversity or multiculturalism or the fact that these ideas needed to come to light in a certain way? Is there a cultural institution that's brought an important exhibition that's going to travel or that's not going to travel so that book becomes a really important vehicle in getting the message out about a body of work that will only be seen through that book? And so you ask yourself these questions that are cultural, they're social, they're empirical, they're historical. And I think that's what makes the conversation with a very small group of seasoned book practitioners, book designers, really, really interesting. That it's both about our joined experience, our individual experience, and a kind of projection for an audience about what's going to have meaning and resonance in terms of design excellence.
Do you think that criteria has changed over the years, considering that these awards have been around since the 1920s?
Oh, that's such an excellent question. And of course, if I were to have been a fly on the wall back in the 1950s and 60s, I really don't know. It's interesting to go back and look. In retrospect, the books that won back then seemed more conservative by contemporary eyes. They seemed more limited in terms of what they could do. Of course, there were exceptions. Bradbury Thompson, a famous American graphic designer, designed many, many books, won many awards, also designed postage stamps, was known for doing these very bold, colorful, exquisitely, I think, crafted books. And there are other books that are black and white and really simple and just have etchings in them and won awards. Why did they win awards? Well, it had to do with that zeitgeist, I suppose. What was possible, what was permissible, what was actionable, what printers could do, what publishers were willing to back. And so in a sense, they really do become time capsules in and of themselves. And each year, it's always painful to have to reject as many as we do. But at the same time, I think it's an extremely rewarding sign for us all that we get between 700 and 800 publishers and book designers from all across the globe who feel that this is an important recognition that they would like to be part of, to be considered for. So it's pretty interesting to think that, you know, since 1923, we haven't missed a year.
Is it important not to be sort of swayed by too much by the zeitgeist and try and find things that have a timeless quality almost.
It's an excellent point you make, and I think you need both. And I think just like any good, you know, all good juries, I think, strive for diversity, not just diversity in terms of international representation, but in terms of color, black and white, illustration and photography, tradition and innovation. That is the zeitgeist also. I mean, my book was, I think, comparatively speaking, and it did get into the show in 2016, was rather conservative by contemporary standards. It was just, it had justified type, right? No idea does justified type. I do justified type because I'm really sort of besotted by the geometry of what a paragraph of typography looks like when you just see it looking like a rectangle. But, you know, I am really in the minority, and that is not, I would say, the major way things are done these days. But I think that when you look back at each show, at each sampling, what you want to see in the 50 covers and the 50 books is a spectrum of representation, that you see different views on things. Particularly, it gets really interesting if you've got, you know, a couple of different kinds of fiction. I mean, fiction on the inside is fiction, right? It's seldom illustrated. And yet, when you look at five covers of books of fiction, or from different writers, or from the same writer, different designer, you start to see a spectrum that is interpretive and about a level of perception and a level of, I think, insight that makes the whole act of reading not only visual, but I think really culturally relevant to a much broader spectrum of people. So I think that that's a general basic idea or ideal in any competition, is that you strive for some kind of range and that you don't just reward the same things. And it's hard because people do, unfortunately, and this is something as an educator I've rallied against my entire professional life, people do get their ideas from looking at other people's work. So the worst thing a student can do, in my personal opinion, is go look at an annual, right? What you should do is go to a museum and go read poetry and go study a second language and learn about genetics and talk to your friends and open up your mind, right? And then the work you make is going to be suitably invented by this sort of plethora of influences you've had, as opposed to just going back and looking at these books. At the same time, to look back at the 50 books, 50 covers shows year after year, there is a kind of an enjoyable spectrum in terms of whatever that curatorial final decision was that was made by that small group of people. But I don't think that that's where the inspiration itself should come from for the subsequent year's entries.
Jessica, just so that we get an idea of your taste and what you are looking for, I wonder if you would be able to name your favorite book cover ever.
Oh my goodness. I don't think that I could. I have favorite book cover designers. I have a particular predilection for photography. I think many designers go to typography first in terms of their solutions, and there's certainly some amazing typographic book covers. But I get very excited when I see somebody using a photograph. I think it humanizes the book for me. I think it makes it more of a sort of direct one-on-one relationship to the fact that there was a person who wrote it. It's about a person. A person had their hand in that thing. It's less abstract in a way. I think the book designers, certainly, that have always come out of Penguin Random House, Chip Kidd, wonderful book designer, all of his colleagues there, I'm blanking on their names because a lot of them have moved around. There's also, I should say, under the radar, university presses, University of Chicago, for example, University of Nebraska, some of the English university presses, Oxford University Press, some of the university presses have extremely gifted designers, and they are tasked with doing really hard jobs. I mean, some of these books are learned, they're impenetrable, they're going to be read by a very small percentage of the population, but that doesn't mean they don't deserve to have some exquisite treatment that jumps off the shelf at you. Fiction, of course, is easier that way because it's imagined. And so I think the book designer by nature has perhaps a longer leash. But to design a nonfiction book, to design a book that's about journalism, to design a book that's about history, to actually work with material that is in the known conscious mind of the reader is a much tougher job. And I'm always impressed by the efforts of some of these university book press designers. And they always win. They always win.
Jessica, it's absolutely fantastic to talk to you. We could speak all day, but we're certainly going to look on with a great deal of interest as the 50 winners are revealed. And those wishing to learn more about 50 books, 50 covers, can head to designobserver.com. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
And now, Tom, shall we continue with some new music? This is fresh from indie poppers Holiday Ghosts, hailing from Falmouth via Brighton, UK. This is Slipstream.
Slipstream. it's gonna last.
That was Slipstream by Holiday Ghosts. Nice, spirited number.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Welcome back. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. I am Marco Sippi and Tom Edwards is in the studio with me.
I am loving the show so far, Marcus. We've set the bar pretty high. What have we got next?
Well, Tom, we're hearing from the London-based artist Beatrice Gibson, whose new exhibit, Crone Music, at the city's Camden Arts Centre, revolves around two new films by the artist. The first, I Hope I'm Loud When I'm Dead, featuring the work of US poet C.A. Conrad and Eileen Miles, was filmed around the US and Europe in 2017 and explores the power of poetry and, by extension, of art in politically febrile times.
The second, Deux Sœurs qui ne sont pas sœurs, Two Sisters Who Are Not Sisters, filters a Gertrude Stein play through a contemporary lens to explore the power of solidarity in the face of social turbulence. Alongside both, Beatrice has programmed a series of events designed to highlight the power of collaboration and the strength that can be found in community.
Monocle's Augustine Macellari met Beatrice Gibson in the studio to learn more.
I've always made work quite collaboratively, and I've also made pieces that are kind of more explicitly about collaboration. Going all the way back, I suppose, a big influence for me has been experimental music and modernist composition, particularly from the 60s. Looking at composers like John Cage, Cornelius Cardew, and they were very invested in collective models of music making. But that's always been a thing that I'm interested in looking at in relationship to film. These two films, or this show, is a bit of a departure, I suppose, in the sense that it's much more explicitly seeking out like a feminist lineage. Obviously, there's lots of friends are in the films, lots of Deux Sœurs qui ne sont pas sœurs in particular is cast with people I love and care about, friends, but also influences, some people I didn't know so well. So there's collaboration happening there in the sense that a lot of what they do and say is devised together. But I think maybe what's different about this show or these two pieces is that they're really explicitly about community and making work in community and making work that produces community as it's being made and really like teasing that out. So the programme of like live events features kind of everybody who's in the films and that, you know, everyone's doing different things, talks or workshops or performances. And it's really about making explicit all the collective work that does go into making stuff. You know, I don't make work alone. I make it always with a team. Often those things go unsaid and historically in a kind of more grandiose way, you know, like the myth of the male genius artist alone at his desk, tortured with somebody putting dinner under the door. Yeah. That's just not like my reality. I make work with friends because of friends. People enable it. It's important for me to make those things really explicit. Yeah, so
it's great to hear you talk about community. I mean, I was just having a conversation moments ago with my colleagues about the kind of, it was actually about retail, but about the kind of atomization of society, which is being helped along by things like the gig economy and the kind of breaking down of jobs into these modular things. There was a thing on the radio today about people having side hustles. The idea that there's no security and that there are a few fixed points. Shops are closing down because everyone's buying things online. Mm. Do you think that there is broadly a kind of appetite for, especially in this metropolis, you know, we're in London now, where pubs are closing or they're changing hands, areas are changing very quickly. Are people looking to kind of rebuild communities, do you think, more broadly? Do you get that sense?
I guess so. It's a basic human urge, isn't it? We have all these Instagram, all of that stuff. You have community, but then you feel you can't touch it and it feels so unsatisfying, really. It's like, yeah, I think things like social media, I'm going to sound like the 40-year-old person that I am now. I wasn't born with all that stuff, but immaterial, fake forms of community, I think they make us really want to touch out, reach out and touch things, real objects. And certainly with me making work, that's definitely I want real objects and people around me.
I feel like there's also this kind of renewed interest in, you know, I love the title of the show, Crone Music, this idea of the crone, which I'd like to hear your reflections on. But this interest in folklore and in the different meanings that these old symbols that have maybe fallen out of vogue in contemporary storytelling have, I feel like that the interest in traditional music, for example, that maybe is kind of coming out a bit more in people. I feel like that all ties into this search for community as well.
Yeah. Well, Crow Music, I just want to say, is the title of an album by Paulinho Oliveiros, who was an experimental musician who died recently, actually aged over 80-something, a couple of years ago. And she was a contemporary of Cage and Cardi and all the composers that I just mentioned. And she was kind of the only woman. Well, not the only one, but one of the only ones. And she was certainly one of the only ones who had like an explicitly feminist project. That album, Crow Music, one of the pieces on it is the soundtrack to I Hope I'm Loud When I'm Dead, almost in its entirety, apart from a small piece by Lawrence Crane, who's a British composer, who collaborated on Dessert, and, of course, Rhythm of the Night. The show is called Crow Music because I was trying to reference the fact that I was trying to tease out this more explicitly feminist lineage. But so the crone is a really nice figure. The crone is like an old lady who is sort of mean but also a bit magic. I like that. I like that combination. There's Paulinho Oliveiros in the show, but there are lots of, aside from my own immediate community, it's very citational. There are lots of other female figures and feminists that it calls forth in the narration for I Hope I'm Loud When I'm Dead. There's Audre Lorde, Adrienne Rich. I kind of speak to older women behind me and kind of bring forward their words into the piece, and then I try to sort of send them forward to my daughter at the end in a letter to her directly. So
you're kind of bridging times. The poetry, there was a lovely line right at the beginning of I hope I'm loud when I'm dead, yeah. Which I was just watching, that poetry can be of use. And yeah, I just want, what it's really good. I mean, what use can it be of?
So that's
and big... art, you know? We know that they can be of use, but what's their use for you?
I obviously struggle with that question all the time, or think about that all the time, because I like to justify, you know, what I'm doing or why I do it. I guess in moments like the world we live in today, which is particularly chaotic and falling apart, and certainly in my lifetime, I've never lived in a moment that's quite so chaotic. And to me, the use of art, what use it has, is thrown into stark relief exactly in moments like that. Because, for example, in 2016... I just given birth to my daughter, kind of hormonal and crazy and sensitive, like everyone is after that big event. Trump got elected, we left the EU, the fucking world was falling apart. It was really intense, as it's been, you know, it's intense for everyone. I had this constantly refreshing 30 seconds new headline on The Guardian every minute on my mobile phone. It's just anxiety producing. So I started reading a lot of poetry. I started reading C.A. Conrad, who features in the film very heavily, and Eileen Miles, and they became a sort of alternative news feed, let's say. And so what use does it have? I mean, I say it a bit in the end of I Hope I'm Loud When I'm Dead. It's like the fact that these things exist in the world for a brief moment make it okay. It's sort of the present tenseness of it, I guess, for me.
That year, 2016, I feel like that was the first of consistently and progressively worse, like, what the fuck years. That, you know,
totally.
Charlie Brooker's screen burn of the year or whatever ended in 2016, yeah. And it's when it should have started, because, you know, you have people like Elon Musk saying we're living in a computer simulation, and sometimes you look around and you think, maybe, and it's being programmed by a lunatic. 2017 was when things were, from the surprise of the kind of populist revolution, if you like, in the UK and the US, suddenly everyone was like, okay, here's Trump and he's being inaugurated. This is real. This isn't a kind of fever dream. And that's where I Hope I'm Loud Where I'm Dead picks up. You continue to film over the course of that year. I suppose I wanted to know how you reflect on the themes that were just starting to emerge. We're now 2 years later and nothing's better.
It's just worse. Yeah,
it's just worse. And how you kind of reflected on those and how you think that you're going to continue to engage with them in your art practice.
Both films, actually, they're made over a two-year period, the period we're talking about. And I'm lucky enough to have work in a context that means that I can make things slowly, and therefore they're very responsive and very organic. I often don't know what they're gonna be when I start them, you know. So, for example, I Hope I'm Loud When I'm Dead, I shot the sort of poetry sections on the night of Trump's inauguration, which was kind of mental and or cathartic somehow, and cathartic. So I didn't know what that film was, really, and I came back to London and looked at the material and thought, this isn't really a film and I need to look at broader political context for the two poets. And then so I gathered all this material that was sort of more around maybe more documentary material, kind of contextualising them. But then I've sort of post that, looked at that, and then wasn't sure what my relationship to that material was. And then looking at Eileen's work in particular, I mean, C.A.'s too, his poetry is very politically urgent. Sorry, their poetry. Eileen's poetry is particularly rooted in a sort of autobiographical, they're an early feminist poet. Their work is a lot about themselves, the character of Eileen. I just had to find my relationship to the material, and so it became more apparent to me that I had to respond to what was going on. And to answer your question that you asked earlier about, you know, what use has poetry got? And that's really what the film became about, was my relationship to the material, my relationship to poetry, and sort of using it as this alternative newsfeed in a time of total chaos. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
I think it does. I mean, it definitely raises another thing that I wanted to bring up. I don't know how much significance you ascribe to the Turner Prize, which is all film works this year. But I wanted to ask a bit about how you think the expectations of art film, what's expected of them, how that's changing. You talk about documentary and things like forensic architecture. Tate was very straightforward kind of documentary. There was some debate about whether it should be included or not, which was quite boring, actually, I thought. It's like, fine, let it be. But what level of engagement do you feel like you want to have with the world around, and how does art, how do films, how can they be used to mediate things like that? It seems like film is less abstract.
I think it's very personal, isn't it? For me, I'm a politically active person. I go to protests. I try to do things. I donate money to things. Yeah, I have a sort of small activist part of my life. And then I have my art-making life. And I obviously think art is political, but I don't think it necessarily has to be explicitly so. I think it has a different kind of an effect. It's not immediately political, perhaps, or it's political in a different way. Art can help you see the world. It can change the way you think about something. And that is a really political act to me, on a very different kind of a level than, say, going to a protest. But I think my films are political, but they're also kind of more self-reflective. I don't want to put the responsibility onto them of having to do political work in a more grandiose way. There is space for me to reflect in a way, in a more personal way, and more concrete political things I can do outside of them. And I do, yeah. But there's different scales and types and forms of politics to me, yeah.
Finally, how, you know, with this, I've just kind of been circling things that I want to come to over the course of the next 2 months, from the end of January to the end of March, the 2 days after Brexit.
Oh, I know, if it happens. I know, it's awful.
There are some things that stand out. An afternoon of mayhem with Obi.
Yeah.
Some nights of composition. Is this the first time that you've really used a kind of programme of live events like this in concert with your films, and that you've worked on this whole immediate and also filmic exhibition?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's also the size of Camden has enabled that. It's the largest show I've had. There are 3 rooms, and I had to do something with each of those rooms. The films I make are quite linear in a way and quite cinematic, and you could easily see them in a cinema. And I think the key distinction between showing work in a cinema and showing work in a gallery is that in a gallery you get this amazing opportunity to tease out context and the landscape in which, you know, the sort of all the voices and all the friendships and all the community that go into making a work. Opius, my 5-year-old son, soon to be 6, he features in I Hope I'm Loud When I'm Dead. Him and I do a kind of mad dance scene at the end. And actually, it was Sophie Williamson, the curator, because everybody in the films is doing an event. She said, "What about Obi?" I was like, "Oh my God, of course, what about Obi?" So, yeah, you're all welcome to come along to that.
I think it's a lovely touch. And that is, you know, that is community. Communities are intergenerational.
Yeah.
There are acts, you know, and maybe so should art be.
Definitely. I think art can be, much as I love the art world, it can be pretty exclusive. Camden actually is a really lovely place like that. It's very welcoming and very... And they started off, I think, maybe that's the difference, is that they started off really as a library and a community centre, and it's really built into their ethos. And their education programme is amazing, and it's not cynical, and it's not done for cynical reasons. And yeah, they're great. So they have a long tradition and history of that that I admire greatly, yeah.
That was Beatrice Gibson talking to Monocle's Augustine Macellari. Her new works are at Camden Arts Centre for the Crone Music event through till the 31st of March. You're with the Monocle Weekly.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Keith Harrison's artworks are known for playing with traditional materials like clay and pushing them to the limits of conventional use. This is a man who made a sound system out of porcelain tiles explicitly for heavy metal titans Napalm Death to play through to see how long they'd last.
His latest project is a collaborative work with artist and producer Beatrice Dillon. We heard from her on The Weekly last year when she brought her dance music beats to Berlin's Atonal Festival. Together, the two creatives, along with the Outlands Creative Network, are making Ecstatic Material, a show in which Dillon's music will be played through a speaker system designed by Harrison, using unusual materials such as Play-Doh to manipulate what's heard. The show will be travelling throughout the UK in February. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Beatrice Dillon and Keith Harrison to hear about what they're hoping to achieve.
I actually studied fine art myself, not music, so I feel quite comfortable talking with Keith about, or looking at this project in terms of the physicality of this project as objects in a space and how you configure objects in a space, as much as thinking about sound and technically mixing the sound in a room. So for me, there are three-dimensional concerns to this. There are also sonic concerns moving around a room. It's a multi-channel sound system, so there are kind of spatial concerns. But yeah, there's quite a lot going on, really, in terms of things you can see and things you can't see.
I think it's very particular to our collaboration because I think all of this has come out of initial conversations, ongoing conversations, sharing images and emails and then meeting up in London or here. So I think we've arrived at where we are with the systems we've got because of all of that previous research and conversation. So it hasn't been that necessarily I've been in one place making this system ready for Beatrice to kind of activate, and maybe that's the way I've worked in other projects, but this one feels much more fully collaborative in the sense of the dialogue between us has got us to where we are, both from the music perspective, I think, and from the physical material and object perspective. I guess my background has often been in live events, and I make works that are essentially made active through often an electrical source. And for me, it's always been that interest in the process and making that part of the public experience of the work as well. So it's often been with clay, and I've heated clay in front of an audience and they've seen it change and react or not. Sometimes it doesn't work as well. Technically, they're often quite challenging. So I've been really keen in maybe all my works to put the process that I'm involved in with materials out to the public audience to see those processes taking place live.
So Keith, talk me through Ecstatic Material. What have you guys been working on together? You're down in Plymouth. What's been going on there?
Well, we've met up 3-4 times down in Plymouth now, and each time I've tried to build part of a system, initially kind of 1 or 2 stacks utilizing a container system really that's provided to us, and I've started putting speakers into those stacks, and then we've been working with various different materials and playing Beatrice's sounds through those materials and seeing what they start to do to the materials. So initially it's about how the two start to come together, but at the same time I think it's also been about stripping away some of the things from our initial ideas, because we had many different ideas around this title of Ecstatic Material. It's been about stripping away some of the things that aren't maybe completely working together. So what we're left with now, I think, are the elements, the components that are almost indivisible in terms of sound, visual and material. I think that's where we are now. And we've got this system that we've set up that we're now playing out throughout the space and with a number of units to it. That's the stage that we're at this point.
So what, without giving too much away, and I know that this thing is going to change as it tours and things like that, but what kind of event should people sort of be expecting to walk into? Tell me about the objects that you're making and how they speak to sound in that way.
Because perhaps we're starting in an art venue, it's very much geared around how it might be exhibited in a gallery space. But at the same time, it is a sound work, and there are a sound system that will play out sound quite purely. And then there's another system which perhaps I've fabricated more, which is these plastic boxes that produced a set of stacks. We've got 12 stacks, all of which have got speakers within them. And within those speakers that are upright, there's various materials that are being shifted around in different ways. And the different sounds that Beatrice is producing are reacting with those materials and, in fact, producing their own sounds as well. So it's like there's both our ends meeting. And then there's almost a bit where it meets in the middle as well, which is almost an indivisible part, really.
And what materials are, though, that you're going to be playing around with there?
I took the salt dough, really, as the inspiration of a material that was malleable and kind of could be made quite readily. So all the constituent elements of salt dough or play dough are broken down into glycerine, flour, salt, cream of tartar, and then put those individually into the speakers and start to just experiment with what the sound starts to do to those materials. And so we're mixing in all senses, really.
Surely the more you work with it, the less random it gets, and you start to understand what sound does with the material and what material does to the sound. What have you learned about the way something like Play-Doh can affect the way that Beatrice's music sounds to the listener?
We're finding the more we're doing, the more we're finding, actually. So you know, as opposed to it almost becoming a known thing, it's almost becoming even more unknown because, yeah, as we're working through the kind of possibilities of opening up rather than closing down, I'm sure Beatrice would feel the same way from the perspective of the music element.
And Beatrice, I mean, people talk a lot about sound systems manipulating the sound and stuff, but to actually be trying to physically manipulate it with changeable materials on site, is that something that you've done before or is this new?
No, I've never done this before. It's a bit of an adventure. I've never actually thought about sound as a vehicle to set something else in motion. I've actually only ever just concentrated on the kind of aural principle of sound. This whole project does kind of push into physical, aural sensory experience. One thing that we're both quite enjoying is trying to find a point where we truly sort of interconnect our two separate disciplines. And the speaker stack, which is the plastic stacked boxes with the embedded speaker inside it and the material laying inside the speaker acts as a sort of vessel to hold the material. And then I'm sending sound to those speakers. That feels like the most connected way of thinking about physical material and sonic material and how these two things are harmonic or inharmonic, depending on what reactions are happening. Feels like the point where our ideas meet very, very naturally together and a third thing emerges, which is the joint work.
There's obviously kind of a serious artistic side to what's going on here, but then there is, on first sight, there is the very playful element of manipulating sound using a material as fun as something like Play-Doh. I mean, are you guys having happy accidents with that? Has it been an entirely scholarly exercise, or have you been having fun doing this as well?
I think that was a huge part of it for us. The title was so evocative of this invitation to play and to push these materials and to see what happens. So I think we tried to embody that spirit, really, that title engendered right at the very beginning. So yeah, the Play-Doh was almost bringing it back to basics, really, of almost elemental play, and kind of broken it down again into its elements. We're building, and yeah, we're finding out, and the systems that we're putting in place, but we're absolutely exploring and experimenting.
Keith, I wanted to talk about some of your past work. Tell us about your use of, I think it was porcelain and something to do with napalm death. Can you explain about that?
That was a sound system and a collision as much as a collaboration, really. And I made a sound system that was clad in tiles. I invited Napalm Death to come and play through just as an extreme energy noise source to see what they would do to the whole system and essentially break it down or break through it if it was possible to see what they would do to material. Yeah, so that took place at De La War Pavilion. They played out and the audience got involved quite unexpectedly. So yeah, that was that piece.
I And what effect did Napalm Death's music have on Tile sound system?
I think people were expecting something quite spectacular and instantaneous, that the whole thing would just explode. And it was always going to be much more incremental. And so it was as much about the audience reaction, I think, to that and how slow it might have been rather than how quick. So the tiles were falling off and then the audience got involved and they fell off much quicker. And probably the level of destruction that was also audience inflicted was probably the level that people might have been expecting from Napalm Death on their own, but it was a bit of both.
And what are you trying to, I don't know, are you trying to make a statement? Are you trying to explore the limits of materials? What kind of outcome are you broadly looking for in across all these experiments?
I think it is, yeah, absolutely exploring the kind of the limits and the overlaps, really, in terms of material, the opportunities that myself and Beatrice have to bring both our practices together and to see where the connections are and where almost the new things that happen out of both our meeting, I think for me have been the big thing so far, and to push that and to take it around the country and see what happens as we go from venue to venue as well.
Beatrice, I mean, when you've been like working in this way, has it set your mind thinking about other materials that you could be making sound via? I mean, has this sort of opened your mind a bit?
It's definitely opened my mind, yeah. The piece that I've made with Keith is entirely made using FM synthesis, which is a very kind of dynamic, rich way of creating sound, pushing waveforms to their maximum capacity. It's much, much richer, much more flexible than using, say, sample-based software or sample-based sound. It's been a kind of perfect project. It's been a perfect way of trying a new process, trying new materials, new systems. So I will walk away from this project feeling very excited to work more with FM synthesis and research that a bit more, really.
Can you give us a layman's explanation of what FM synthesis involves?
Basically, as far as I understand it, it's the possibility of having one waveform push or instruct another waveform. So it's effectively like having one engine moving another engine. So you have multiple ways of shifting and moving a waveform. So it's a bit like using black and white and suddenly having a kind of colour spectrum to work with. In the past, I've mostly worked with like sample-based systems, which are quite limited because you have one sound and you're just kind of stretching it like plasticine into a new shape. Whereas this is really building from zero upwards. To be honest, there are so many variables in the systems that we've set up that there's kind of enough to be thinking about with the materials at hand, the plastic, the glycerin, the salt, bass, high frequencies, mid-range frequencies. It's a deceptively simple-looking setup, which actually contains lots of different variables, all kind of connecting and not connecting at points. So we both think that there's definitely scope for turning it into a more gallery-based installation, less a performance, more like a sort of a durational piece. So as a kind of next stage, I think there could be work to be made together continuing on from this. But right now this is completely engaging and challenging and really, really interesting.
Beatrice Dillon and Keith Harrison there, talking to Monocle's Tom Hall, and their show Ecstatic Material begins on the 7th of February, continuing on throughout the UK over the month. You can head online to find out more. You're with the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
And that's already all for this edition, 499 of the Monocle Weekly. By the way, can't wait for next week.
The big 500?
Exactly.
10 times older than Marcus Hippie.
Right. How will you celebrate that special occasion?
I don't know, but I'll probably be here in Studio One on Sunday week, I imagine.
Exactly. We'll be probably with Tom Hall and Augustin Macellari, who, by the way, produced today's programme. This show was researched by Martha Libri as well, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Marcus Hippie.
And from me, Tom Edwards. Goodbye.